This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 13th of April, 1957. The title of this lecture is Radiation and Scientology. It is Radiation and Your Survival, tape number 7. Copyright 1957 by L. Ron Hubbard in the United Kingdom. Copyright 1978 by L. Ron Hubbard in the USA. All rights reserved. Unauthorized translation, duplication, importation, and distribution is a violation of applicable laws. This tape is 61 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Thank you. We are now going into radiation and Scientology and concluding this series of three lectures which are directly aimed at the subject of radiation. There are a number of things which have been learned during the past year and a half in Scientology which directly relate to radiation, and it would be a great shame not to make these things public at this time. For a Scientologist, this is very, very far from a hopeless subject. We already have data of sufficient importance and figures of sufficient reliability to demonstrate that the Scientologist, by processing and by processing of others, can very easily nullify such a minor thing as a polluted atmosphere. How does he do this? Well, we must consider radiation, as I told you in the first lecture, as something of a worry. And when a person is at a level where his general physical health is good, then this worry is not capable of depressing him into ill health. We care very little about whether there is radiation in the atmosphere or not, because a person who is in excellent physical condition does not particularly suffer from the effects of radiation. Now, that sounds like I'm saying, well, the answer to it is for everybody to get processed up to the nth degree and he'd be all set and squared around, and therefore, let's just beat the drum for more Scientology processing and let it go at that. And that sounds like I'm saying that, and that's what I'm saying. Now, the factors in Scientology which are most definitely influenced by radiation are the factors which are most definitely influenced by life. And when we try to divide a peculiar illness from the general illness of being alive, we are at once at loggerheads with the fact that man is as well as he is well. And the infinite number of factors which can make him ill, if each one had to be taken up separately and independently and distinctly with an entirely different treatment, would discover us with our noses always and forever stuck in to the newest, latest disease. You follow me? That would be our fate. Now, we don't do that. Although our noses may be stuck in the latest technique, I'll let you in on something. The latest technique has always run out and made nothing of the earlier techniques, and that's why it is the latest technique. You're not studying then a new ill. You're studying a method to eradicate the cures of former times, and the nullification of Scientology processes themselves used earlier. Not that they need nullifying, but it just so happens that that is the case. Each time we make an advance in our technology, we make an advance so that we wipe out earlier technologies in active processing. Actually, that might interest you scientifically, the exact way that a technique is tested. How good is it? How bad is it? Well, it's as good as it runs out earlier techniques. The technique which runs out another technique, a technique which eradicates and throws into restimulation and eradicates, another technique is senior to it. Wouldn't you suppose this? All right, let us say that we are treating smallpox or something of the sort, and we come up first with a serum, and we make everybody bare his biceps, and we take a large horse needle, and we hold on to them, and we shove it in them, and we shoot them with it, and so forth, and it makes their arms swell up, and they get ill, and they don't feel well. But they probably do or don't get smallpox. But that was our cure for, or prevention of, smallpox. All right, then we come along, and we decide that this stuff could be bettered, and we perfect it and refine it, and we make somebody take it by mouth, orally. And we say, now that's going to do it. All right, that's fine. And this seems to have a good workability. And then we discover something that has to do with a particular hot bath. And if we give somebody this hot bath, why, then he won't get smallpox, or it'll cure smallpox, you see. All right, let's take those three. Now, the one which is senior to the other two would run the other two out. It's quite interesting that if the hot bath technique was a good, pervasive, sweeping technique and was a considerable improvement on older techniques, when you put the man in the hot bath, he would at once feel sick at his stomach from the pill, and his arm would tend to get swollen from the old shot. Follow that, see? And then the pill and the old shot would not trouble him anymore. Now, that doesn't much happen in physical medicine, but is not unknown. And with ourselves, if we take somebody and run him through a technique known as HC, and as it goes, after a while, he begins to say, by the way, a Scientologist had been looking at this all the time and had never cognited on what it was, so possibly there's somebody present has never realized what was happening. He suddenly remembers having been audited by Joe and Bill and Pete. Well, what do you think's happening then? Well, 8C, run well, is running out the techniques administered by Joe and Bill and Pete. Now, those techniques are still in evidence, but what they eradicated is gone. And the only thing that's left to run out, really, is any residue left by the technique and the technique itself. Now, to that degree, we cure cures. It's very amusing, but it's highly probable, that that's all we ever cure. It's very probable that man has had cures all up and down the track which have become the diseases of tomorrow. And if we can solve the factor of the cure that becomes a disease, which, by the way, we have solved, we are then capable of actually curing. Let's take alcohol, for instance. Do you know alcohol was once the greatest medicine that man had? It was a wonderful medicine. Anything happened to the fellow from snake bite to a love affair, any disease. What did we do? We grabbed him by the hair of the head, stretched his throat. That's all. That was the cure. And now we have alcoholism. It's interesting that only a century and a half ago, the stores of a British man of war amounted, in terms of weight and pounds, more than 50% alcoholic beverages and less than 50% food, salt horse and dried peas. Now, that's quite fascinating. Alcohol was a tremendous thing, but here's an oddity. Today, alcohol makes people feel tired. Oh, isn't that an oddity? It's been laid in on the genetic line, evidently to such a degree that it now produces the illness which it was most used as a remedy for. Anytime you got tired, you took a drink. In past years, we conceived the genetic line, just giving genetics their due, that the blueprint is marching along, you know, and that it accumulates these things. Quite interesting, quite fascinating. You talk to a geneticist and you mention something like this to him. It is definitely in the woof and warp of his own subject, but he has never realized that the experience the body line has in one generation may culminate in another generation. Even so, Darwin found out that when you took horses up to the high country in the Middle East, they would then grow long hair after a season or two. But when you took them, these long-haired horses now, back down into the low, hot country, they wouldn't get rid of the long hair, just in case, for about four generations. Ah, this is a very fascinating fact, isn't it? It tells us that the genetic line does carry a memory with it of what's happening. See, there's many proofs and incidents of this character. Well, very few people have ever added this into the field of medicine, taken it out of the line of natural selection, put natural selection into medicine. You give a drink to somebody today, he gets tired. In other words, it restimulates that which it was made to cure. Now, possibly on the genetic line, at some time or another, just being very far-fetched about it, radiation might have been a cure for something. And using this other principle that the cure eventually becomes the disease and eventually re-stimulates the disease it was supposed to cure, I'm sure that somewhere on the genetic line, radiation was used for a bad stomach, for a bad skin. Get the idea? And sure enough, it was and is today sunbathing. Now, what is the sun but a ball of radiation? Of course, these are photons that come down, but don't think these photons aren't hand in glove with a great deal of other radiation. Radiation is all over the place. When you lie out in the sun too long, you get a sunburn. What is a sunburn? A sunburn is not an overdose of heat. It is not an overdose of anything under the sun, but radiation. That is a radioactive ball that rides across the sky up there. In my basic physics textbook, to show you how opinions have changed, when I was not in high school, they used to teach that the sun was combusting on hydrogen, and that there was an inexhaustible supply of hydrogen, and they calculated the length of life of the sun on hydrogen. And this was very, very nice, but it didn't work. Because if its length of life was calculated on hydrogen, then you would get a difference in the heat of the sun from year to year because it was burning out. And this was an interesting fact that you didn't get this difference, and so the theory was eventually abandoned, and people finally owned up and said, we don't know why the sun burns. And it was only until nuclear physics became dominant in men's thinking that they explained sunlight. And sunlight is occasioned by a continuous fission going on a sphere called the sun. And sunburn is a radiation burn. It's as silly as this. Now, you look at people who are burned in an atomic blast, such as they were at Hiroshima, and you were looking at the outer fringes of things that look very like sunburn. For instance, a chap was standing in front of a picket fence. He was standing with his back to the picket fence, you see. And the bomb exploded way back of him somewhere. And he had sunburn where there weren't pickets. In other words, he got a burn pattern just like you'd get wearing a bathing suit. In other words, you go out and you wear a bathing suit and it covers up certain portions of you. No, they don't get sunburn. So does radiation work the same way? Well, now when radiation is drifting around in the air all the time, you're getting no direct burn. You're getting a sort of of a continuous, intolerable type of burn, which is too imbalanced, and your absorption of it you find unhealthy. But nevertheless, you do have a great deal of experience with sunburn on the genetic line, tremendous experience. And sunburn causes, occasionally, hives, red flushes, prickliness, and an upset stomach, and colitis. It will even cause loss of hair. Now, this is a fascinating thing. Yeah, you girls never go out in direct sunlight when it's real hot, very, very hot. Some slight will happen to your hair. You generally wear something. Brunettes turn dusty, and blondes turn sort of brindle. Pinto. Down in Arizona, the careless girls down there, they occasionally, why, they turn up, they look like pinto ponies. In other words, here is something with which we have experience. So it's not new and strange. There's just more of it, and it's drifting in the wrong place. For instance, the body, finding the sun shining in a room like this at this moment, says, what's this all about? Now, we've also had X-ray. X-ray, oddly enough, has been used for a cure for cancer, cure for cancer, cure for cancer, all the way up along the line. A cure for cancer? It's very interesting. It must have been in vogue for some time, for the excellent reason that X-ray causes cancer. And it's no surprise, after a while, if you try to cure something long enough and often enough with anything, it will eventually cause what it's trying to cure. In other words, its effectiveness will wash away. We then have to handle this cure factor. And we have that. Technique knows problems of comparable magnitude, problems of incomparable magnitude. In other words, the solution of a problem is the problem, not a solution. If you want no liability in any solution, then its solution is the problem. Now, if somebody out here decides that his wife is too crazy and he takes her down to a head shrinker, I beg your pardon, that's an Americanism. Britishism is a trick cyclist. And they put big electrodes on her head and so forth, and she comes back, and what's she suffering from now? She's suffering from having been electrocuted. So one day she walks over to the light, and she turns it on, but it's short-circuited, and it gives her a slight shock, and she's crazy all over again. I mean, this happens. It's quite common. They're using electricity in some wild, barbaric fashion in some offhanded attempt to cure this. I am actually being very stylish and in vogue today in condemning electric shock. As a matter of fact, this is no longer new. Everybody's fallen into line, and even Oxford is now condemning electric shock and released a book condemning it a few months ago. This business of curing things carries with it the liability of leaving the cure sitting there. So we're going to cure some disease by running a fellow's temperature up to 107 and leaving it there for 48 hours. And then a few years go by, and something's wrong with this fellow. What's wrong with him? Well, he gets hot. You follow this? So, you have to have somebody conceive of problems of comparable magnitude to the problem in order to take his fixation off the problem. And as long as he's fixated on the problem and then solves it, he continues to be fixated on the problem. You get the idea? He just put a barrier between himself and the problem. He solved it by putting in a barrier, but the problem's still there. What you've got to do is raise his tolerance for that type of problem. And the moment you've done that, you have it solved. In other words, the solution is always the problem. You have to be able to, quote, handle, quote, tolerate, quote, confront the problem. When people cannot confront the problem at all, they solve it completely. They become obsessed with the solution of it. Do you see that? All right, let's look at radiation. People can't solve it, can't confront it. Well, I should say they can't confront it. It's drifting all through the atmosphere. How are they going to solve this? Just have somebody look into space for a little while. You say, don't look at anything. Look into space. After a while, his case is in rather poor condition. He'll get queasy. All right, we take radiation, we scatter it all over the place, and we tell everybody, look, it's floating all around in space, but you can't see it. Everybody starts going like this. And after a while, he feels queasy. In other words, we can produce to a marked degree all of the effects of radiation in Scientology with the greatest of ease, simply by a re-stimulation. All you have to do to turn on a flush is to say to somebody, now, do you recall a time when you were sunburned? He says, yes, I do. I was dreadfully sunburned. Once I lay on a beach for a couple of days, and at the end of that time, why, they didn't know whether to serve me up between the middle of a cut bun or to butter me. So they buttered me. And he says, I remember that. And you say, well, was that extremely painful? Oh, yes. Yes, very. Now, what did you do? What did you do to cure it? Oh, I did so-and-so, and that didn't work, and I did so-and-so, and that didn't work. And you just at that moment say, well, nothing works on that, does it? No, I guess I found that out. He'll have a sunburn. Stick him. You have to stick him in the moment of a sunburn, just as one can be made to relive past experiences, so can you be made to relive all past illnesses. And if you audited him very badly, so as not to call it auditing at all, you would leave him stuck in these moments of illness. And there you would have it. You could turn on the sunburn. Now, how about this colitis, gastroenteritis, and so forth? Just make him look into space, make him look into space, make him look into space, make him look into space. And if he's liable to get re-stimulated or upset by dangers in the atmosphere, what are you going to have? You're going to have somebody sick at his stomach. This is a test that anyone could make. In other words, if we made people look into space and attribute vast evils to space, we could make them ill, physically ill. We can demonstrate that. We don't even have to go into the whys and wherefores that it happens. But it is true. So therefore, attracting everybody's attention into space and only into space is liable to get him to suffer all sorts of interesting things. Space, by the way, is a re-stimulator for being sunburned. Isn't it? I mean, you were usually out in the open and in the sunlight. So you make somebody conscious of the fact that he's in space, you're liable to get these various actions. Pollution of space. Danger in space. You are a total effect and you can do nothing about it. Those are the combinations which bring about this condition we know as radiation sickness, from our viewpoint as Scientologists. And we can do something about every one of them. If you were to make somebody sweat it out, and you wanted to do this, and he wasn't in too bad a condition, he was in good auditing control, all you would have to do is ask him for a problem of incomparable magnitude to radiation. He can always get one of those and build him up, and he'll probably give you a problem of comparable magnitude to radiation. And you have given him something to confront that is like radiation. And he can confront this, and you're giving him practice in confronting the unconfrontable. And we can do this. This we can do. All right, what are the other factors? Radiation is being used as a control mechanism. It's being used to control people this way and that, to do this and that. They're not supposed to go to war now. That's one of its control mechanisms. And they're supposed to obey countries that do have radiation and so forth. That's a control mechanism, isn't it? As it goes on, by the way, it becomes more and more apparent to people that it is a control mechanism. Actually, I won't go so far as to tell you that it has been used as a control mechanism, but that happens to be a parascientological guess. Control. As long as a person is allergic to control, he will suffer from attempts to control him. You tell people, now listen, a Scientologist is somebody who controls people, environments, and situations from tone for hate. You could rewrite it this way. A Scientologist is one who, when he wishes to control people, environments, and situations, controls them only from tone 40. He does something about it. He is practical. He's very direct about it. You get the idea? That's quite different, isn't it? Well, don't you suppose that if everybody has an allergy to control and to being controlled and thinks there is something wrong with control, don't you suppose that is an aberration? Don't you suppose it's something that you should handle in an auditing session? Don't you suppose it's something you should raise the tolerance of people on? Obviously, it's a suppressive factor. They're so afraid of being controlled, they resist everything. And when they get afraid of radiation, when it's used as a control mechanism, they resist it, and it burns them, and only then does it burn. They have to resist it. They have to say, I don't like that. Don't let it near me. And all of a sudden, they fry. Now, you can conduct this experiment. You can take somebody you don't like, and say, isn't it terrible about this radiation? Isn't it terrible? Think of all this air around here in this room at this moment being full of little invisible particles that are just chewing you to bits. He says, yeah. Yeah, I get the idea. I don't know why I'm itching, though. People right now, having heard the first lecture, have an itchy back. That's right. You'll pass away rather rapidly. Why? We call attention to this stuff. That's all. However, if calling attention to it produces a reaction to it, and as sooner or later somebody is going to have his attention called to it rather forcefully, don't you suppose that it's better to call our attention to it than not? Yes. All right. Now, here's control. If people are allergic to control, it's then something they ought to settle with themselves. A person can only be controlled against his will so long as he is allergic to control. So long as it is against his will. A person who is very, very bland about the whole subject, who doesn't mind being controlled, who does not conceive there's some tremendous danger to him in being controlled, can one be controlled as easily as a little toy? And two, can knock off that control as easily as a giant. He has power of choice over control. I never understood why, when I was audited by an auditor, myself, that I never got into trouble with auditors. It didn't matter whether the auditor was untrained, newly trained, something. They audited me. There was no difficulty as far as I was concerned. Yeah, they sort of leave me stuck on the track once in a while. I get into other difficulties with them, but they were just their difficulties. I did what they said. I didn't worry about it. I knew they couldn't get me into very much trouble. I had a certain security. I was not worried about this. I had confidence in the subject, no great fear of the mind, because I'd looked at it. And the fellow would say to me, all right, I'll go back to birth. And so on. I'd go back to birth. What's wrong with that? He'd forget to tell me to come up to present time. I could always wait until after the session was over and tell birth to go back to the past. There was no great liability in it because I wasn't afraid of what he'd do to me. Because the truth of the matter is, he wasn't going to do anything to me. But I didn't have that determinism either. Every once in a while, somebody audits me, and he goes out and he tells people, you know, Ron is about the easiest fellow to audit you ever audited, but he's awfully cranky at times. What they're talking about is I do what they say, and they think I'm pedantic. I do exactly what they say. Exactly. In other words, I don't try to make a session out of it or change it or alter don't start self-auditing in the middle of the session, don't you see? The fellow says, can you move your right foot? And I say, yep. He says, well, go ahead. I say, which direction? No, go ahead and move your right foot. All right. It's all right. Now he says, can you move your left foot? I say, yes. He says, what's the matter with you? I don't know. What's the matter with me? He says, well, you're not doing what I say. And I said, I'm sorry. Always be courteous. I didn't know that you had told me to do anything. He said, yes, I did. I told you to move your left foot. I say, you did? And he said, yes. And I said, well, all right. And he says, well, why don't you move your foot? He has yet to give me the auditing command. There is no control factor present unless I put one there. And if I put one there, there's an intermediary control, isn't there, that has nothing to do with the auditor and nothing to do with me. So he finally gets it through his skull that when he tells me to move my left foot, I will. So he says, oh, I get it. I get it. Move your left foot. And I say, okay. Now, once in a while, somebody gets his temper ruffled or something like that. And if at that moment I resisted his control, I would later on find that I had a nice big facsimile mental image picture of that session at that moment. Get it? I'm not setting myself up as any paragon of virtue. If I set myself up as anything, it would be as somebody easy to audit. Now I'd get more auditing. Actually, this is just propaganda.